I'm with Satish Kumar, and we're down in the Devon countryside. It's a beautiful place in the west of England. We're at Schumacher College, which Satish founded in the early 90s. Now, this is all a long way away from where you grew up in India and your beginnings, really. And reading your book recently, you became a monk at the tender age of 8 years old. It seems very young to me. How was that for you?
It was very young, but a child is not an underdeveloped adult. Child is fully a whole being. And in my view, a child is capable of making a decision which is appropriate to his or her age. And you might say that maybe this was not such appropriate decision for my age, but I think it was. Because when I was only 4 years old, my father died. And I saw him lying dead, not moving. So I was sort of surprised why he was not speaking to me. And my mother was crying. My brothers and sisters and whole family were in sad and painful situation, crying. And so I was sort of walking around the house asking everybody, what happened? What happened? What happened? And I asked my mother, what happened? Why father is not speaking, not moving, not walking? And so my mother said, he's dead. And so I said, what do you mean dead? She said, he's never going to speak to you again. And so that was so shocking that I thought I must do something to stop anybody dying. And I want to stop my mother from death, and I want to stop myself from death. And so that was such a deep and profound experience of death at the tender age of four, as you call it, that I went to see the monks to find out if there was a way of stopping from dying ourselves.
You were with the monks of the Jain sect. Can you tell us a bit about what that sect represents?
There are four major religions in India. One you would call Hindus. The second is Buddhists. The third is Sikhs. And the fourth is Jain. These are the four indigenous religions. Of course, in India, you have Christianity and Islam, but they came from outside. So these four indigenous religions have much in common, but particularly Buddhism and Jainism have much in common because they were founded more or less at the same time. They are contemporary religions. The supreme principle of Jain religion is non-violence. And they take non-violence to such an extreme that they don't even harm grasses and plants. And of course, they are vegetarians, and they will not even tread on any grass, and they will avoid harming any smallest of the small creatures. So non-violence, the supreme principle of the Jains. And then meditation is the second important principle, that through being attentive and aware and present and mindful in everything you do, that you can live a life of wholeness and a life of non-violence. And so through non-violence and meditation, that I grew up for 9 years while I was a Jain monk. And Mahatma Gandhi was much influenced by Jains because he made the personal non-violence of the Jains into social and political non-violence. So there are about 10 million Jains in India, and it is a very powerful religion. There are many beautiful temples, beautiful carvings, and there are Jain monks, Jain nuns, but not everybody has to be a monk or nun. Lay people can practice Jainism and practice non-violence as much as possible. They are, in the main, pacifists because of their non-violent way of life. They will not join the army. So that is mainly Jain religion.
Now, you followed a guru, And what was life like following the teachings of a guru?
You know, my guru, Jain guru, was Tulsi, and he was a very profound practitioner of nonviolence. And therefore, it was not just a kind of intellectual idea, but it was for him a kind of deep experience. And also, he was very charismatic. And also, he was someone I trusted fully. So he was almost a spiritual friend, although there was a gap of 20 years between us. But I could trust him, and he had trusted me fully. So guru is a person you can trust fully. And guru is someone who gives you advice and guidance which is not in his own particular interest. Guru is always thinking of your interest, the interest of the disciple. And so I surrendered my ego, my separate I-ness and separateness. And I just said, I will do exactly what my guru says. So I followed his advice and his guidance in my personal life. And I went where he told me to go. I studied what he told me to study. I practiced meditation the way he told me to practice. So I did exactly for 9 years what he said to me. And that was, he was my father almost, a kind of spiritual father. He was my guide. He was my friend. He was my philosopher. He was my teacher. And so, and I learned much from him. And it was very easy for him to just do what he was guiding me to do. But that was not a blind following either, because I also could see the point of what he is teaching me. So it was a kind of voluntary acceptance of his teachings. It was there was no force. He was not sort of telling me that you have to do it. If I did not want to follow his advice, I could decide at any one moment that I will leave him. And so I did. When I decided that that is enough for me, I will not follow my guru anymore, I left. And there was no problem in my decision.
Someone else who also struck me through your writings was when you talked about monk Kundun and seeing him, and he wanted to die by fasting. I mean, what impression did that have on you?
This is a quite a standard Jain tradition that when you are old and when you are unable to function and your body is so frail that you become too dependent on others and you cannot survive and be yourself, then it is right and proper for a Jain to undertake fast unto death. And monk Kundan felt that way. He said, I'm now too old to function, and so I will die by fasting. And it was very respectable. And when he was fasting to die, there were many, many people who came to see him, to bid farewell to him, and also singing and hymns and chants and meditation and blessings. So it was almost a celebration of his life. And it was a very good way that he suddenly didn't die and nobody knew. People knew that within 10 days or 2 weeks or whatever, short time, he is going to die. And so I thought it was a very dignified and a very sort of beautiful way of dying. But I was always a kind of, because I was so young in my sort of 11, 12 year old, so I was very sort of anxious that this my beloved friendly monk who I like so much will be gone like my father went. And so it was a second death within such short time. So I was a bit anxious, and I was thinking that as a monk we should be able to overcome death and be free of death. And how come that he is going to die So there was a kind of anxiety in my heart, although everybody was celebrating and singing and chanting and praying and blessing and so on. It was a beautiful atmosphere, but I was very anxious. And so I said, Kundan, are you going to sort of completely disappear, or will your soul survive? And he said, my soul will survive, because soul cannot die. Spirit cannot die. It's only the body will die. And so I was sort of asking him, will you then come and tell me that you have survived and you are in heaven, and what will happen to you? And he said, yes, yes, I will come and tell you. So that kind of little bit of childlike conversation that I had with him. But everybody else, all the other monks and lay people and Jain followers, were very happy that monk Kundan has lived such a wonderful life, and he's dying in such a courageous and such a brave manner.
Now, although you've said that you had your own free will to leave the Jains, you do talk in terms of it being a bit like an escape, in fact, which your mother wasn't happy about. When you returned to your mother, she didn't seem that pleased that you come back to her, and then you ended up going to live in an ashram. Yeah. What was that whole episode like for you?
It was an escape, because I could leave. There was nothing legal or nothing else which was stopping me, but the kind of a community pressure, you can say. And particularly my family pressure. My mother believed that once you become a monk, you have taken a vow. And if you break that vow, this is a very dishonorable thing to do. And so she said that you should remain a monk. And if you have given up the monk, I can't accept you back in my house. Because what will the community members will say, that I have taken the monk back? And that will not be very good for the order. So in a way, that was blessing in disguise. Because my mother did not accept me back, new doors opened for me. And I went to live in a Gandhian community, which was started by one of the great followers of Mahatma Gandhi, called Vinoba Bhave. And this was a community where people practiced organic farming, growing your own food, self-sufficiency, and living simple life. So it was not miles far from the monk's life. It was a very similar life, still practicing non-violence, but more social and political context, still practicing meditation. But in addition to that, doing some gardening and farming and growing food and cooking and living a community life. And moreover, working for the poor and depressed and oppressed and exploited in the villages, untouchables. And so I was bringing the spirituality in everyday life, practicing spirituality in social, political, and ordinary life. And that was tremendously inspiring. Because if you retire into monastic order and practice spirituality just in your personal life, it becomes a bit navel-gazing. It's a kind of too self-centered and a kind of personal growth type of spirituality. Whereas Mahatma Gandhi and his community was making spirituality more relevant to everyday life. So my mother, not accepting me at home, gave me that opportunity. And I call it a blessing in disguise.
And I sense that Vinoba was someone who made a great impression on you, was very inspiring in your life. And as regards taking that action, land reform was something you came to feel very passionately about, didn't you?
I did, because I left one guru, but I was very lucky to find another guru. And that was Vinoba Bhave. Now, Vinoba was a great scholar of Sanskrit language. He was a learned man of philosophy, of all religions, Hindu, Buddhist, Jain, Islam. He spoke 14 languages, and he was a true follower of Mahatma Gandhi in the sense that he went around India. He walked over 100,000 miles persuading landlords to be compassionate and share their land with the landless, because unless you share the land, there is no development possible. Because if you just give money, give something for a short time, that doesn't last very long. But if you give them land, then they can make their livelihood forever. So development as sharing. This was a great message of Vinoba Bhave. And he managed to persuade landlords and collected 4 million acres of land and distributed among the poor and untouchable and landless people, and created many, many communities. He said, the idea that we can own the land, we can own sunshine, we can own air and water, you can own forest and trees, we cannot. These are sort of gifts of gods, so gifts of natural world, gifts of goddess Gaia. We cannot own them. So the ownership of nature and ownership of the earth and land is a kind of wrong idea of humans. And therefore, we must consider ourselves as trustees of the land. The trees and forests and land and animals are kith and kin to humans. We are no sort of owners. So he challenged the idea of ownership and instituted the idea of trusteeship. And that was very inspiring to me, because this to me was a very much a Jain principle. So this was a sort of seamless shift from a Jain monastic order to a community life, an ashram life of Mahatma Gandhi.
Another man who inspired you was Bertrand Russell. And you say that in the early 60s, you actually remember hearing about the arrest of Bertrand Russell in London, all the way over there in India where you were. And this actually inspired you to do a pilgrimage for peace. And you began walking through India and across Pakistan. I think you did about 700 miles in 2 months. But your actual destination was Washington. The intended destination was Washington.
That's right. Because the reason that intended destination was Washington, because Washington was and still is the leader of the nuclear weapons and leader of the war preparations and military expenditure. America still spends $400 billion a year on defense budget. No other country can match that kind of expenditure. And so I decided to walk from India, from New Delhi, from the grave of Mahatma Gandhi, actually, to Washington, D.C., going through three other nuclear capitals, Moscow, Paris, London, and taking this message of Bertrand Russell of nuclear disarmament, of world peace, to Moscow, to Paris, to London, and then ultimately to Washington. And I walked 8,000 miles altogether over 2.5 years. And that was, in a way, following the idea of walking. As a Jain monk, I walked. Then with Vinoba Bhave, I walked. I walked for land. As a Jain monk, I walked for personal growth and personal enlightenment. With Vinoba Bhave, I walked for the poor and oppressed to distribute land. And then I walked to Moscow, Paris, London, and Washington for peace in the world. And Bertrand Russell, at the age of 90, going to jail for peace in the world, because he was arrested and he was put in jail because he was offering direct, non-violent, direct action and civil disobedience. So when I heard that a man of 90 going to jail for peace in the world, I was only 26. I said, what am I doing? I must do something to support this world movement for peace. And so I undertook that journey with a friend of mine, another Indian friend. So two of us. And then Vinoba Bhave also gave us this idea that if you are walking for peace, you must have a trust in your heart, trust people, trust in God, and not take any money with you. Go as a pilgrim for peace. And pilgrims don't need to take money. So I walked without any money in my pocket, not a penny. and I depended completely on the hospitality of local people throughout the world, whether they were poor countries or rich countries or communist countries or capitalist countries or Muslim countries or Christian communities or Jewish communities or any religion or rich or poor, whatever. So I really experienced the ecology of the earth by touching the earth and walking upon the earth. And I also understood the unity of life and the unity of people. People are people everywhere. All these identities and all these labels that I'm a communist, I'm a capitalist, I'm a Hindu, I'm a Muslim, I'm an Indian, I'm an American, all these are secondary identities. The primary identity is that we are all human beings. And that I experienced by walking 8,000 miles throughout these countries.
You've actually written about your legs being the most creative part of your body at that time. And you said that no one you met on the walk didn't want peace, but there was also no one that seemed to know how to achieve it.
That is true, because so many people throughout that decade of 60s, particularly during the Vietnam War and during the late 60s, 68, 69, throughout the 60s, millions and millions of people around the world, from India to Berlin to Rome to New York to Tokyo, everywhere, were protesting against the bomb. And yet people felt so powerless, and that politicians, although they elect them, and they elect them to keep peace in the world, and yet these politicians fail to keep peace in the world, and they wage war in Vietnam, they wage war in Korea, they attack other countries, and these big powerful countries don't pay any attention because they feel so fearful and so insecure, and they think that if we lose weapons, then we will lose control over people, and they will lose control over countries. And this fear of losing control is driving them to spend so much money on armaments and weapons. When people have no water, people have no food, they have no shelter, they have no medicine, they have no education, and yet the powerful countries of the world and all governments of the world are prepared to spend money on futile armaments and futile nuclear weapons, which are insane world, never going to be used. So such a waste of money. So people felt powerless, that in spite of all this protest, in spite of all these voices raised against war and nuclear weapons, nobody's listening. And that was the powerlessness of people that I felt everywhere.
And what about today? I guess that's the next question. Here we are, spring 2003, early summer. The latest issue of Resurgence magazine focuses exactly on this.
It is very sad that the world is still going downhill on that sort of path of wars and conflicts and sort of mini civil wars and mini wars, like in Palestine, in Iraq, over Kashmir, in Sri Lanka, Northern Ireland, still not really at peace. So this really saddens me that in spite of so much knowledge, so much information, so much science, so much globalization, that whole planet is a small global village, and we can communicate with everybody if we want to, through internet, through mobile telephone, through faxes, through so much communication, and yet we are so afraid of each other. So that really saddens me. And although, in spite of all that, people are still taking care of each other, and there is still a lot of compassion and love in the world, and that is a balancing factor. Nevertheless, it deeply saddens me and depresses me that humanity and the leaders of the world are still hell-bent on spending their energy, their imagination, their talent and time, and their money on weapons of mass destruction in countries like the United States and United Kingdom and France and India and big countries. So this is a very, very saddening and depressing time we live through. But I'm still optimist that eventually the human spirit and human consciousness will rise, and we will find a way of resolving conflicts through nonviolent means, because we have great examples of success of nonviolence. If you look at South Africa, one man walked out of prison, and after 27 years in prison, he said, "I'm not going to take any revenge." And Nelson Mandela became president of South Africa. And we have seen nonviolent transformation taking place in Eastern Europe. And what did Mikhail Gorbachev do in Russia? That was a nonviolent transformation of Russia. And so there are other examples of that kind. And I hope that leaders of the world like Blair and Bush and Sharon and Palestinians and other leaders learn those examples, and examples of the Dalai Lama, who is still fighting in nonviolent way for the freedom of Tibet. So I think those examples are my inspiration and my hope. And those examples give optimism.
After Walking for Peace, you spent some time living in a forest in India. You've already touched on your profound connection to the earth, to nature. You came back to England, though, in the early 70s, and you came here to live, really. Now, your involvement with Resurgence magazine really started when it kind of fell into your lap. How did that happen?
It fell in my lap because Resurgence magazine, to promote ecological worldview, started in 1966. And peace was also very important for Resurgence, but peace not only between people, but also peace with nature and peace with yourself. So a very comprehensive peace. But the editor, John Papworth, went to work in Africa. He became a personal advisor to the president of Zambia. And so he met me in London once, and he said that without me, there is no way Resurgence can survive. And they have decided to close down all the people who were working for Resurgence. And so how about you taking over as the editor? So that was almost, as you say rightly, that fell in my lap. And I said, wow, what a challenge, what an opportunity. And so I took over because I felt that we need a voice, and Resurgence can give that voice to a more holistic way of thinking, interconnected way of thinking. Magazines in general work in a single issue focus. So either they are focusing on peace, or they are focusing on ecology, or they are focusing on social justice, or they are focusing on a kind of equality, some single focus. Well, I thought that these all things are connected. And so in order to present that interconnection of these ideas and these movements, Resurgence can be a good vehicle. So for the last 30 years, I have been editing Resurgence and presenting these ideas as interconnected whole. I have given a new trinity through Resurgence: soil, soul, and society. Because soil represents the natural world, the ecological worldview, because everything comes from the soil. Our food, our clothes, our houses, our sustenance, whole life is sustained by soil. So if we don't take care of the soil, we cannot maintain and sustain life on this earth. And second is soul. If we do not take care of the soul qualities of friendship, of compassion, of love, of unity of life, of beauty, of community, these are soul qualities. And if we don't take care of these qualities, and we become just materialistic and just money, 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 status, 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 career, 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 then we will lose out. So soul qualities are as important as soil qualities. But then we cannot stop on a personal soul qualities. We have to extend these soul qualities into society and social justice and a fairness in the world distribution of economic welfare and well-being for the poor and oppressed and exploited. And so these are also as important. So like French had equality, liberty and fraternity as their three main principles for French Revolution, and as the Christians had Father, Son and Holy Spirit as their spiritual trinity, and as New Age movement has mind, body, spirit as their personal trinity, for the age of ecology and for the age of holistic thinking and wholeness, we need a new trinity. So resurgence represents that trinity of soil, soul, society. And I'm delighted that I have been able to make some contribution through resurgence.
There was one time that you visited Japan, and that gave you some very fertile material for resurgence. And you went to Fukuoka's natural farm, and he actually said, "I feel a lonely traveler. I'm going in one direction while the whole world is going the opposite way." Do you ever feel like that?
Not quite as extreme as he felt, because he was particularly speaking about the way we treat our earth, particularly our land, the farming methods. He was saying that we treat the land as if we are enemies of the land, and we are at war against the land. The way we poison the earth, we put chemicals and we put poisonous fertilizers, and we put this all sprays and herbicide and pesticide, and the way we bring heavy tractors and machinery on the land and plow the land as if we are sort of tearing it apart. He was a naturalist. He was a scientist. He wanted a relationship between human beings and the land to be of harmony rather than of this kind of exploitation. And so he was feeling very lonely in his voice, because Japan at that time was so hell-bent on economic growth, that no other values were important. And he was feeling very lonely. But I think he made a great impression. He sowed the seeds, metaphorically as well as literally speaking. He sowed the seeds of organic farming and caring of the land that now, all over the world, people are turning away from this monoculture more and more, and moving towards organic farming. And in Italy, for example, there's a great movement called Slow Food. And that slow food movement is to appreciate food. And food is not only to feed your body and survive, but food is also a social and a cultural phenomena. And it is also a spiritual phenomena. And over food, you can make friendship. So it's a soul quality. And so I think Fukuoka was feeling lonely at that time. But now he's 100 years old and still alive. And now he should feel more encouraged. And I feel encouraged that more and more people are turning towards sustainability and environmental issues and renewable energy, solar energy, and all this local economy. So these movements are gaining strength more and more. And even mass media are reporting. The Guardian has produced a very good supplement on food, which tells you that what we are doing to our land and our food. So I feel optimistic.
You mentioned the importance of connection to nature, which in replenishment terms is yangna. There's also danya and tapas. Can you just say a bit about those?
In India, particularly in the Hindu tradition, we have been taught these three principles of replenishment. And I think those three principles are very relevant to our time now in terms of sustainability and social justice and personal growth, personal development. How we relate, because we are using the earth. We have to take food from the earth. We have to take trees to build our houses. We have to take energy from the earth. So if we just take, then all the resources will be depleted. So Hindu principle of yajna speaks to you that when you take something from the earth, you must also pay attention to replenish it. And how do you replenish it? If you take one tree, plant five trees. That is yajna. If you take something from the earth, like you take grain, rice, wheat, or vegetables, then return what is not used, what you have not eaten, return it back as compost, back to the earth, and that way nourishment of the soil will be replenished. So always be mindful and attentive to the idea that you are not here only to take everything from the earth and then throw it away on the dump or on the landfill or in the rubbish bin and not return it to the land. So that is the idea of yajna, to be mindful to replenish the natural world. The second idea is tapas. Tapas is to replenish yourself. You cannot just work for others. And you cannot just work for the banks and building societies and sort of shops and supermarkets and some offices and so on, because you are always using your intellect, your emotions, your physical energy, everything you are using. If you do not replenish it, you will be burnt out. And so in order to stop being burnt out and depleted personally and sort of exhausted personally, you need to give yourself time. And that is tapas. So you fast, you meditate, you go on a retreat, you go for walking, you walk in nature, and you give yourself time and space to replenish yourself so that you are able to keep your energy level such a way that you are going, you can serve the earth, you can serve the society, you can serve the world. And that is the way of replenishment of the self. But also, you must replenish society and community, because you have received so much from the society. You have inherited so much wealth, so many buildings, so much culture, music, arts, architecture, religions, poetry, all literature, everything we have received from the earth, from the society, so to speak. As we receive food and everything, sustenance from the earth, we receive culture and everything else from society. So it is our responsibility to replenish. Otherwise, if we don't replenish society, the river of literature and culture will dry away. So we must contribute poetry, art, and that is dana, giving back and replenishing the society. So my trinity of soil, soul, and society is very close to yajna, dana, and tapas. So you replenish the earth, you replenish your soul, and you replenish the community and society. So that way you practice yajna to replenish the earth, you practice dana to replenish the society, and you practice tapas to replenish yourself.
You started a publishing company called Green Books. That made quite an impact. And you've also founded Schumacher College, as I said earlier. It's been very influential in inviting eminent thinkers and scientists and philosophers and activists. And now this must be quite something for you to behold.
Yes, I am very happy. But of course, Schumacher College was established with the help, great help, of Dartington Hall Trust. And they supported it with finance, with buildings, with lots of support. And then there have been lots of people, as a teamwork it has been. But you know, universities are no longer universities. They have become diversities. They are just upholding the unsustainable industrial paradigm. And they are not looking properly and comprehensively about the way we are going to survive in the future. So the issues of ecology and sustainability are so urgent that we need to study, and not only study but practice. So at Schumacher College, learning and living are a seamless continuum. And of course, we get people here who are coming from all over the world, great thinkers and activists who are sort of developing ideas, but also projects, practical movements, and they come and teach here. And the students also come from all over the world. We have had people from 80 different countries to study here. And so when they have spent 3 weeks or more, and sometimes 1 year as students of the holistic science, they go back, they start new project of sustainability, they start new schools, they start new curriculum in their universities, they start different kind of businesses, they initiate renewable energy projects, they initiate many, many projects. So Schumacher College is a kind of catalyst of change, and giving education and training to people to implement the ideas of sustainability in their own countries, in their own communities. So it is not just you get a piece of paper as a degree to get a job. This is not the work of Schumacher College. It is to inspire people and give them tools and ideas and support so that they can begin to do something in their own communities. And the people who are coming here are engaged in sort of frontiers of ideas and change, like new sciences. Fritjof Capra comes and teaches here. Brian Goodwin, holistic science, science of complexity. Gaia, James Lovelock is one of our regular teacher. And he has given us this theory of Gaia, which is very close to Buddhist thinking of interconnectedness. He says that whole earth is acting like a living organism. Now, this is a wonderful scientific theory, but no university is properly studying it. But here, we are able to give a master's degree in this kind of science. So, Schumacher College has been truly an innovative project, and it is making a big impact in many countries.
You said that your life has been a quest for self-realization, and your autobiography is titled actually No Destination. Does that mean that there's ever a point of arrival in your journey?
No, there is no point of arrival. Life is a journey, it's a quest, and it's a process. Life is not a product. Everything is all the time changing. We are evolving. And even scientific theory of evolution is a good theory. So my idea of no destination and the scientific idea of evolution fits in very well. We are all the time evolving. There's no straight jacket. There's no fixed arrival. There's no product. Life is not a product, final product. So quite often people get into dogmatic situations where this is it. I know the truth. I believe this. And this is it. I said, no, life is always unfolding. It's a journey. There's no point of arrival. So life for me is a long journey. And even death is not the end of life. It's only a passage into new life.
Satish Kumar, thank you very much.
Thank you.